Good evening. I'm Eric Bergloff. I'm the director of the Institute of Global Affairs. This is a wonderful opportunity to hear Professor Richard Baldwin talk about, I think, one of the main challenges that we are facing and that we have seen also have an impact on election and referenda outcomes, the whole idea of globalization and how to think about it. I think there's probably no one that I can think of who has thought more deeply as a trade economist about this. We are delighted to have Richard here. Richard is the president of the Center for Economic Policy Research, which is this network of economists, sort of the academy of economists in Europe. He is a professor at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. He has also the founder of something that you have seen, the Vox EU, and is still father editor-in-chief of this, and I think it has had an enormous impact on sort of the conversation between economists and the public, and he's done a tremendous public service in that project. So I don't know if there's anything more I should say, but you know, you have an audience here that will challenge you, but I give you the floor first to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Does this thing work? I'll put this on so I can do that.
Yes, it does.
Talk show host wandering around the room kind of thing. On? Yes.
Yes.
This class just got out. Okay. Well, thank you, Eric, very much for those kind words. And thank you all for coming here tonight. What I want to do tonight is change the way you think about globalization. Not really a radical revolution as to how you should think, but at the end of this time we're going to have together tonight, say 90 minutes, I hope you think that globalization has a lot more to do with knowledge flows, and perhaps not quite so much to do with trade flows as you would think now. And indeed, what we're going to do is we're going to start out with a rather shocking thought experiment, where we're going to pretend that globalization has nothing to do with trade, but only knowledge. And we'll see how far that gets us. So let's see if that works. It's not because I believe this is true, but I think it might be useful in broadening your perception of how globalization works. Okay, so one way to do this is to start with a set of facts, which are defining facts for the new globalization. And then we're going to consider them, trying to explain them, trying to see whether trade is the driving force or knowledge is the driving force. Okay, should we start? So the first thing is two facts. Manufacturing and GDP share have shifted from G7 to a few developing countries. So have a look here at the left line here. This is shares of world manufacturing. So we're focusing on manufacturing. And this is data goes back to the 1970, and you'll see the G7 countries, which are the big four European countries plus Canada, US, and Japan. They started with about 70% of world manufacturing was in these seven countries in 1970s, and it glided down gently until 1990 and then fell somewhat more precipitously, and it went from between two-thirds to under a half in these two decades. Now, since these are global shares, the G7 share loss must show up in a G7 share gain, and not surprisingly to most of you, the primary gainer was China. China went from 3% of global GDP to over 18%, about 19% But there were six other rapidly growing countries, which I'd like to call the I6 or industrializing six. That was China, Korea, India, Poland, Indonesia, and Thailand. And they went from they each got together another 3 or 4 percentage points. Now the interesting thing about this is the gains to this handful of developing countries was hyper-concentrated. Because basically you had 7 countries who lost and 7 countries who won. The whole rest of the world didn't change very much. Another 200 countries didn't change. So whatever it is about this globalization, it's not like the old globalization where trade costs came down and it changed the entire world. People traded more everywhere. This was very concentrated, a movement of manufacturing from one group of countries to another group of countries. The rest weren't changed much. That's the share of GDP. The second one is the G7's share of world GDP. And here you can see this is sometimes called the Great Divergence. We go back to 1820 here, which is more or less when modern globalization started. And the G7 had a share of world GDP of about 20% or so. That was their share of world population, since incomes weren't that different across the world. Over the 170 years up to the early 1990s, the G7 share went from a fifth to two-thirds. So these 7 countries had two-thirds of the world's income and output by 1990. But since 1990, that share has plummeted in the last 2 decades, and it's now back to the level it was in 1900. And this is the title of the book, The Great Convergence. This is the Great Divergence. This is the Great Convergence. So that's, in some sense, the international facts. What I want to look at now is globalization's asymmetric impact. So globalization was disruptive in the G7. Labor's GDP share fell, and the reward to knowledge rose. And so we got frustration, economic disenfranchisement, Brexit, and Trump. Not in that order. Now, the point is that this is not always the way trade affects economies, and it's not the way the old globalization affected the economies. In fact, the share of labor share of GDP did not fall systematically until about 1990. And the increasing reward to knowledge, some of this is stuck in people's heads, like your heads. You do very well out of this globalization stuff. But part of it is stuck in knowledge-based capital of companies like Amazon Twitter and YouTube, et cetera. Now, in globalization in the emerging markets was very different. Globalization was cohesive in the emerging markets. A middle class flourished, and 650 million people rose out of poverty. Globalization is an issue in the G7, but it is not an issue in the emerging market. There is many, many people in the emerging markets are 2 or 3 times richer than their parents and frequently 10 times richer than their grandparents. So in emerging markets, although they had to break some eggs and it's been socially difficult, globalization has been a wonderful thing. But not all the emerging markets. Lots of the emerging markets were completely left aside by this. And lastly, trade agreements got deep. So a number of people call this hyper-globalization, including Paul Krugman and Danny Roderick and Arvind Subrahmanyan. They call it hyper-globalization in the sense that the trade agreements no longer seem to be about trade. And you're surely familiar with the TTIP, which is recently having some troubles. And it's not the trade bit of TTIP that people are having troubles with. It's with all the other stuff. So these are 5 facts of globalization: the manufacturing, the GDP, the fact that it's asymmetric between the rich and the poor countries, and the changing nature of trade. Now, what I want to do is see how far we can get explaining this, completely ignoring everything you learned in international economics. Forget about Ricardo, forget about Krugman, Mellitz, none of that. Let's just forget about that. Let's just say, or ask, what if globalization was about knowledge flows instead of trade flows? And I hope you realize this is going to be some blue skies thinking. Okay? Because there's the blue sky. You got it? Okay. All right. So let me be extreme to be extremely clear. What I'd like you to do is suspend disbelief for a little while. It's going to take about 5 minutes. Those of you who don't like this sort of thing can think about England. I'll let you know when we're done. First, suppose everything is made from know-how and labor. And then suppose that trade costs and trade barriers were unchanged since 1990, so that changes in trade costs are not a driving force in this hypothetical experiment. Nothing changed. So everything that happened was not to do with trade as a driving force. And lastly, suppose in 1990 some pipelines opened that allowed knowledge to flow across borders. So this is a hypothetical experiment. And here are the pipelines I want you to imagine. So we have the US, Japan, and Germany, the three high-tech manufacturing centers in 1990. They accounted for over half of all manufacturing output at the time. And they open up pipelines with Mexico, China, they're all with China, and with Poland. Now, we're going to call the ones down on the bottom factory economies, and we're going to call these headquarter economies, okay? Now, what I want to look at is to review the 1990 situation to see which way the knowledge would flow. So in the headquarter economies, basically the G7, we had high know-how per labor ratios and consequently high wages. In the factory economies, we had a low know-how to labor ratio, and that implied low wages. Now what happens in 1990 is a pipeline opens up that allows the know-how from here to go to the low wages there. So that's what globalization in this thought experiment is. Knowledge starts flowing to arbitrage know-how to labor ratios between these two regions, but only where there's a pipeline. It doesn't go through the air, it goes through the pipelines. And the pipelines, as you probably figured out, are global value chains and international production networks. Okay, what would be the impact in this experiment? Well, first of all, manufacturing shifts from headquarter economies to factory economies. Why? Because now you can produce in the factory economies manufactured goods with high technology and low wages. And that's a nearly unbeatable combination. Because if it's made in the G7, it's high tech and high wages. If it's made in the non-factory economies, let's say South Africa, it's made with low tech and low wages. But that cannot beat China working with high tech and low wages. And by tech, I mean managerial, marketing, and technical know-how that teaches them how to do things that they couldn't do before. The factory economies would, of course, experience growth from this because it's a huge inflow of knowledge. And as we know, knowledge is the jet fuel of growth always and everywhere. Capital accumulation, everything, comes from innovation and technological progress. And so we get the great convergence. Remember, trade has, I haven't talked a word about trade. We get the great convergence only from knowledge flowing. Now, the factory economies would embrace policies that foster the knowledge flows because they're loving this stuff. And the headquarter economies would embrace policies that protect knowledge flows. So that explains hyper-globalization, why the trade agreements are not about trade anymore. Like Krugman says, TPP is not a trade agreement. Well, and he's right. But in this world, it's pretty obvious the trade agreements are protecting the knowledge pipeline, not the good trading goods. So it's involving all sorts of things besides trading goods. And it also allows us to understand the Danny Roderick's globalization paradox, because it's not very paradoxical that the factory economies are changing things inside their economy to welcome this knowledge. And it seems somewhat confusing if you think it's all about trade, but if you think it's all about knowledge, it's completely expected. Okay, so let's then look at what happens inside the headquarter and factory economies. So inside headquarter economies, labor GDP share falls. Quite simply, the wages in the G7 were high because they were the only ones who had access to the high tech. Germany could be a low-cost producer in goods despite the high wages, but that's because they had the technology. Now, when somebody else also has the technology, that undermines the monopoly position of labor and brings them more directly into competition with foreign low-wage labor. So their share of GDP comes down. But it is a share, so it goes somewhere else, and it goes to the knowledge owners. Their share of GDP rises, and globalization is disruptive, which we'll talk more about. In the factory economies, middle class flourishes, hundreds of millions of people rise out of poverty, and globalization is cohesive. All the other developing countries are puzzled. Why aren't they growing like China? And the answer is they don't have a pipeline. So I don't really want to leave you I'm tempted to just stop here and go to questions and answers. That would be kind of fun. But I want to not leave it like that. This is an irrealistic thing. But if you don't remember anything else, remember globalization can be explained to a large extent by knowledge flows, not trade flows. That's the takeaway. You can write it down. It's not cheating. So what I want to do is, how do we put the knowledge flows back in the box? How do I get this broader perspective of globalization to fit with Ricardo and all the traditional ways? And the way I would want to do that is to propose a broader perspective on globalization that focuses on three costs that form three constraints to globalization. Trade costs, which is the cost of moving goods, communication costs, which is the cost of moving ideas, and face-to-face costs, which is the cost of moving people. Now, what I'm going to argue is that these costs fell, but not all at once. And the order in which they fell had momentous impacts on the global economy. I call this the three cascading constraint view of globalization. And we're going to go through those. First of all, let's imagine what happens before 1820 when all these costs are high. Basically, people are tied to the land because they're growing the food they eat with a small surplus. And any kinds of goods they need are produced within walking distance because it's prohibitively expensive to move anything anywhere. Now, of course, if you're a prince or a priest, you may be able to buy some faraway goods, but it'd only be exotic stuff or maybe some raw material that you absolutely had to have. But trade was basically impossible, very difficult. And in trade theory, we model that as autarky, no trade whatsoever. Now, when the steam revolution came along, it radically lowered the cost. Lower the trade costs made high volume trade feasible, and comparative advantage made it profitable. So the steam revolution in this launches the old globalization. So here we have the lower trade costs, high communication costs, high face-to-face costs, and consumption and production can separate globally, and we get trade. That is the traditional story of trade and globalization. Trade costs were what drives it. Trade costs come down, production separates internationally, and we get international trade. But that's not the end of the story by any means, because production clustered locally as markets expanded globally. Large-scale manufacturing micro-clustered in factories to save on communication costs, not trade costs. So here's the deal. You can sell to the whole world. You have the big world. So large-scale manufacturing becomes feasible. Now, large-scale manufacturing is really complicated. And in order to coordinate that, to save on communication costs and face-to-face costs, you put it all together in the same building, which we call factories or industrial districts. So this change in the global economic geography was driven by the fact that we lowered trade costs, but not communication costs, and we got the factories. But that's not the end of the story. The fact that it's hard to move ideas had a momentous effect. First of all, the micro-clustering fostered innovation. So the clustering of manufacturing and factories ignited a bonfire of innovation and growth, where it was easier to innovate because there had a lot of people together thinking about the same problem, and the demand for innovation increased because you could produce so much. So this industrial revolution got going in part because the factories were micro-clustered. But that's not the end of the story, because high communication costs meant that the northern innovation stayed in the north. There was a lot of innovation, a lot of industrialization, but that stayed in the north because it was hard to move ideas and people. So what we had was a massive knowledge imbalance appeared across the globe. I hope you like my infographics. I've been talking about this for 10 years, and I tried equations and regressions and stories, and now I went with cartoons. So I hope you like it. So, you know, it's like, I don't have to explain this one, do I? No. Okay, good. So that is, in essence, in this view, the three cascading constraints, why the great divergence came. Between 1820 and 1990, knowledge was being created at an unprecedented rate in the North and staying in the North, and that drove up Northern incomes faster and further than it did in the South. So after thousands of years of stagnation, where there was zero GDP growth anywhere because of this, the knowledge was spread out, we got a fantastic growth in the G7, which corresponded to a fantastic crash in the GDP shares of India and China, just to take two very large countries. Okay, so that's the old globalization, and I think it was valid up to 1990. And when you start thinking as a profession for something for 170 years, it usually starts to stick. But I think everything changed in 1990. The ICT revolution launches the new globalization. So in my view, the steam revolution launched the old globalization, the ICT revolution launches the new globalization. So lower communication costs made offshoring feasible, vast wage differences made it profitable. So here we have lower trade costs, lower communication costs, but face-to-face costs remain high. So this idea of breaking up the factory and putting stages where they're most appropriately cost, so low-skilled intensive activities go to low-wage countries, high ones to high-wage countries, etc. And it's all coordinated and kept going by the internet or communications and things like that. Now, this is what most people focus on: foreign direct investment, offshoring, increased trade in parts and components. That's what you read about. That's exciting stuff. But I think that misses what's revolutionary about this. The point is, offshoring led to knowledge offshoring. To ensure offshore production met seamlessly, G7 firms offshored know-how along with the jobs. So the miracle here is that the light bulbs are circulating between the offshore factories and the onshore factories. So, for example, when Bombardier, a Canadian aircraft producer, moved tail production of one of their business jets to Mexico, they were not using Mexican labor, Mexican capital, and Mexican technology to make tails for Canadian jets. That's not what they did. They took everything they needed to Mexico, except some labor, and started making tails down there. And that completely changes the rules of the game. That denationalizes comparative advantage. Comparative advantage is based on the concept that nations are the correct unit of analysis, and that the technology is defined by nations. So we can talk about Canadian technology or Mexican technology. What we found out in the 90s is it wasn't Canadian technology, it was Bombardier's technology. And with the ICT revolution, they were able and capable of moving that technology away from Canadian labor and to Mexican labor. So the miracle is now these knowledge flows. And the knowledge flows were created by global value chains. So you can see now the pipelines are the global value chains or the international production networks. So this new high-tech, low-wage combination transformed manufacturing globally, and those huge share shifts that we saw are generated not because it's cheaper to move goods, but because it's cheaper to move ideas and profitable to do so. So we get massive north-to-south knowledge flows, partly rebalancing knowledge, and I'll let you puzzle that one through yourself. Okay. The result was the Great Convergence. So in other words, in this view, the exciting things about this enormous convergence that's causing so much tension in the G7 countries and so much joy in the emerging markets, the factory economies, is that knowledge started crossing borders, not trading goods. Okay. So that is the basic view of globalization, what I call the three cascading constraints. And at the end, I'm going to talk a little bit very speculatively about what happens when the third constraint comes down. That's when it gets really exciting. So I'm going to kind of skip this. I'm going to try and go through a little bit faster some of this stuff. But first I want to ask, in light of last week's election, how broader narratives explain today's anti-globalization in the G7 countries. So there's two things. First, the new globalization broke the monopoly that G7 labor had on G7 know-how. And that was world-changing. So before, German labor took advantage of German technology, and they were a team. There was obviously some discussion over the size of the pie, but they were a team. When you were making a German car, it was with German technology used by German workers in Germany. And when this changes, German labor and German technology are not necessarily on the same side. I like an analogy, a football analogy, a football club. So let's suppose we have two football clubs who are thinking about trading players. And if this trade actually takes place, both teams obviously gain. Otherwise, we wouldn't have done the trade. Everybody gets a player that they needed a little bit more of in exchange for one they needed less. That's the old globalization. The new globalization is like the coach of the better team going to the pitch of the worst team on the weekends and training them up. Now that is definitely going to lead to a more competitive league. And it's certainly good for the worst team, and it's really good for the coach who gets to sell his knowledge to two teams, but it's not at all sure that it's going to be good for the better team. It could be, might not be, we don't know, but it's not a definitive gains from trade as it is in a Ricardian exchange. It's a different deal. The second thing is that the new globalization operates with a finer degree of resolution on economies. So here I have two infographics. This is the old globalization. And I want to explain this in a historical example. So let's suppose this is the American car industry in 1975 or 1980. There's a product that's a car, and there's stages of production there that are mostly around Detroit, and each stage has certain jobs. Now, when the Japanese, those of you who don't remember, the Japanese were the Chinese of the 70s and 80s, and the U.S. was the U.S. back then. So when the Japanese auto industry got good, Japanese high-quality, low-cost autos came to America and competed with American cars, both having been made with Japanese or American technologies. And the Americans did not do well in that battle. The Japanese did very well. But the entire car sector, American car sector, was hurt. All the stages were hurt. Everybody in the jobs, skilled, unskilled, whatever, they were all hurt. It was a team. And the competition was coming in at the level of the product. And those of you who are students, that's what we do in trade theory. The only connection between countries in trade theory is competition in the goods markets. So that's the old one. Now, the ICT revolution in the new globalization opens this up, and it's feasible to unbundle the factory and move things away. So the international competition can come into the factory and outsource one particular manufacturing stage. So that guy, this people in this stage are hurt in some sense. But now, since the factory as a whole is more competitive, the people in the other stages may actually be helped. So the international competition is reaching into the car industry and helping some bits of the car industry and harming other bits of the car industry in the G7. And now, more recently, it can come in and hurt one particular job in the processing. So it's much finer resolution. In some sense, the ICT revolution, by fragmenting sectors, meant that globalization was reaching into the economy with a much finer degree of resolution. So, I'm doing this in a negative way because I read a book about public speaking, and you're supposed to scare people so they listen. So this is all a threat. But see, here at LSE, we should turn them all around and make them blue. This is going to allow you to sell your services to a broader audience. So globalization opens up our opportunities and competition, and when you're LSE students, you're probably going to be on the winning end of this deal. But if you're, a barely school leaver in Northern England, you're probably on the red arrow side of the deal. Okay, so the point of this, the result of this, is economic anxiety, fragility, and disenfranchisement. So with the new globalization, it's not sectors and skill groups anymore. Forget about Stoper Samuelson, what you've learned about. That is no longer relevant. Globalization is not affecting the economy by sectors or skill groups. It's much finer than that. The point number one and number two means that the globalization's impact is more sudden, more individual, more unpredictable, and more uncontrollable. It's more sudden because foreign competition springs up like a mushroom farm. Everything they don't have, the outsourcing firm brings. So production can shift abroad extremely fast for certain stages. It's more individual for this resolution thing. You don't know whether you're going to gain or lose because the whole thing is fragmenting. It's more unpredictable because we don't actually understand why the whole thing was stuck together and exactly what needs to be together. And companies are exploring. They outshore stuff, sometimes they reshore stuff. It's unpredictable. We don't know what's going to happen. In the old globalization, we could talk about sunrise sectors and sunset sectors. And you could predict that if you were in a labor-intensive sector in a high-wage country, you were going to get it in the neck sooner or later. But if you were in a high-skilled sector, globalization was expanding your opportunities and you'd probably prosper. But it doesn't work that way anymore. One way to think about it is no matter what job or skill you have, you can't really be sure that your job won't be next. And that creates the fragility, the disenfranchisement, the anxiety. I would go so far as to say it affects the slope of the Phillips curve, the lack of wage responsiveness to tightening labor markets, because nobody's really sure about their job. Okay, I hope you like this one. Took a long time to find that one. So now I want to talk about future globalization. And I took it off because, but I was in Washington last week, and here it said, we're going to need a bigger boat. But I wasn't sure everybody in England would get the jaws, especially at universities. Okay. I mean, because you're so young, that's what I meant to say. Right. You know what a CD is? Okay. All right. So, what I want to do is start with a heartwarming story, because again, this book I read about public speaking told me I should start with heartwarming stories. I should try it. So this is from the Times, November 12th, a surgeon saves Syrian lives by Skype. Now this guy is a trauma surgeon, and he's helping surgeons, the people getting blown up all the time in Syria, and he's helping surgeons in Syria figure out what they should do. He looks on Skype and says, that's the ligament, connect that to this. So he's helping save people. Is that a heartwarming story, or is that a massive disruption foretold? Because Skype works both ways. Here, it's a high-tech guy in the north providing services in the south. But it could work the other way around. Technology is starting to allow us to unbundle labor and laborers. That's the third unbundling. When the face-to-face constraint relaxes, people can provide labor services at distance and therefore arbitrage the wage differences without actually being there. So that's the idea. So the question is, could telepresence, and this is very speculative, it's in the last chapter of the book, but I think I'm going to develop it further in future work. So the question is, could telepresence and telerobotics allow individual jobs to be replaced by virtual migrants, or in essence, international telecommunicating? Oh, my time's up. Can I give myself 5 more minutes?
Yeah.
Thank you. So let's talk about robots and telerobots. So this is a robot, and it's run by artificial intelligence. 2 weeks ago, I was in Japan, and I took this picture in Ginza, which is a fancy shopping district in Tokyo. And those of you who've been in Japan, you know, at the fancy stores, they have a line of young women greeting you as you come in the store. That's all they do is, you know, please come in, greet, and they'll answer questions about where stuff is. Now, this was a Burberry store, and there was 2 women greeters, humans, wearing Burberry coats, and Pepper, who's a robot, a human, supposed to be emphatic robot called Pepper. They put a Burberry coat on him, too. And he's got these big eyes, and you walk around, and he follows you, and he can shake your hand and stuff like that. And I went in, I was fascinated by it. And so I went in, and I talked to him. He was talking Japanese, which was a bit of a problem. But he did follow me around, and then I asked her, does he speak English? And she pushed a button on the back of his head, and sure enough, he speaks English. But it was very artificial. That's what I think puts the artificial in artificial intelligence. It really couldn't get any interaction to it. Just as an aside, I didn't have the heart to tell this lady that she was replacing herself. That next summer there'll probably be 2 robots and 1 lady, and the summer after that, no ladies. But that's telerobotics. It's a robot driven by artificial intelligence. This is a telerobot driven by remote intelligence. So this is some expert driving around. I don't know where that is. It looks like some some sort of office. But that person is controlling the robot and can sort of drive around in the office. She sees him and can talk to him, and he can talk to her. So it's a robot, but it's being controlled by remote intelligence, not artificial intelligence. And that's the whole point about telerobotics. So let me just, instead of trying to get technical or do cost calculations and things like that, I just want to show you some pictures. So this is telerobotics today. So this is from BBC, a surgeon who operates from 400 kilometers away. So this guy is manipulating things, and there's a machine a robot that's holding the scalpels, who's doing the surgery manipulated by him 400 kilometers away. So that's a telerobot. He's driving a telerobot, and this is the guy who's very happy at the end of it. You know, he's in some remote part of Canada, and he got himself operated by a doctor just in time. This is another one you all know about, a little bit less civic. He's driving a drone and shooting. This is a telerobot, is shooting missiles remotely, driving it. But that robot is being driven by remote intelligence, not artificial intelligence. Okay, so where could this go? Just think about the jobs that telerobotics could offshore. So just to let you know, two of these are made up. They're like clips from science fiction type things. And all the rest are real robots. Most of them are driven by artificial intelligence. But almost all the artificial intelligence robots also can be controlled remotely. There's usually a remote control stick. So people could be doing housework. And just notice that robot has enough dexterity to unload a washing machine. Helping disabled people. In Japan, it's a big deal because they don't have any young people to take care of them, but helping old people in and out of bed. This is a doctor visiting a patient in a remote hospital, providing remote services. This is a robot doing a very dangerous demolition thing, and this guy is controlling it like this, 3 meters away, and probably getting paid £20 an hour. There's no particular reason he couldn't be in Uganda or Kenya doing the same thing for £2 an hour. Here, this is one of the made-up ones. It's a robot driving a car. Why not? I mean, after all, which would you rather have, a robot driving your car with remote intelligence or artificial intelligence? So it's hard to know which would be better. And this, you know, taking care of your houseplants and whatnot. So the point here is that most manual jobs will, when the robots get cheap enough, be possible to be provided in rich countries by people working in poor countries. So it's like virtual migration. And that could be very, very disruptive. Well, many, many jobs, low-end jobs, are protected by the fact that you have to have face-to-face or face-to-machine contact. The street sweepers, security guards, hotel cleaners, all those people, they have to be there, and therefore they're not in competition with foreign workers. But with telerobotics, they would be. And in case you're getting comfortable that this is somebody else's problem, brain jobs could also be offshore with telepresence. So, for example, here's an average monthly salary in the U.S. of a university professor is $6,100. In the Philippines, it's $400. So we could have Pepper, you know, being driven around by a professor in the Philippines, providing some of the lecture services and some of the counseling services that are now provided by people who cost $6,000 per month. School teachers, again, it's a little more than 10 to 1. So again, you're not going to get rid of all the school teachers, but aren't there some things that the school teachers are doing that could be done by a telerobot with communication? Helping correct exams, giving intensive one-to-one care. Maybe part of all your jobs could be provided by telepresence. So maybe you just all be half-time, and the other half of your job is replaced. Engineers, the same thing. So that's Pepper again, or a version of Pepper, helping that teacher teach. That's the sort of one real teacher, one teleremote, one, this is artificial intelligence, but it could be. And here are engineers working on a car through telepresence. That's a real thing where they can cooperate. These guys are, you can, if you look around, it looks like they're all very expensive people, but it could also be from countries where the wages are one-tenth of what these guys are making. Okay, so the basic idea of this is that remote intelligence would mean more G7 disruption, more developing nation opportunities. So most of you will have seen this is a hollowing out of the labor force in the G7. So what you have is the skill range, high skill, mid skill, and low skill. And this is for all the countries. The job growth has hollowed out in the mid skills, but grown in the low and the high. But with telepresence and telerobotics, telerobotics would probably empty out a lot of this. Telepresence could empty out some of this. But of course, it would be superstar economics. So if you were really good, let's say you were a really good university professor, you could be giving lectures to tens of thousands of people instead of dozens, and therefore you would earn out of it. But your other colleagues would have to find something else to do. Okay, so that, but notice, again, this will allow a much wider range of those left behind developing countries to participate because the face-to-face constraint's not binding. So a lot of Africa could be providing hotel cleaning services through remote and therefore participate in it, or South America. So being a far away is much less of a problem for this sort of thing. So I think the way to think about it is what has happened in manufacturing due to offshoring, fragmentation, and outsourcing could very easily come to the service sector that we think is protected by high face-to-face costs. So as I presented to my students just the other day, you ought to think about how you're going to telerobotic proof your job. Think carefully about your job choices. So how would you prevent you being replaceable by somebody steering a robot far away? It's an open question, but I'll let you solve it yourself because I don't have any answers.
I note that you put Sweden in G7.
Sorry. Was this G7? Okay, yeah, that's true. Okay, all right. I promoted you, so I thought. Okay, so that's the end of the book. That's the end of the talk. And the book has lots of stuff in it, which I didn't have time to talk about. 300 pages in 30 minutes, so I would have had to read very fast and probably wouldn't have understood anything. But here's the whole table of contents in case you want to see it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. So I'm going to take questions now, and please introduce yourself. And we have roving mics, so one in the middle here, and who else? Anyone else? Okay. So. Sophia. Okay, please.
Thanks very much. Gary Regenin, former economist at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Studying economics, does this talk mean that globalization is not a positive-sum game, but in fact a zero-sum game, and therefore have we always been living in a mercantilist rather than a liberal internationalist world? Thank you.
Is that a question, or is this Jeopardy? I'm supposed to guess the question.
No, that's the question. Is it a zero-sum game as opposed to a positive-sum game, which is what economic theory seems to have taught us all along?
Okay, so let's collect a few questions, and then we have one up here.
Hi. I work in IT in banks, and the last 10 to 15 years, I've seen a lot of my programming colleagues I work with are in India instead of Britain. There's still a bit of mix. It tends to be a bit of Eastern Europe as well now. A key factor why it's India rather than China or other countries is the language. And my questions around that is how much of this convergence requires a common language? And will we all converge on English, or will there be separate sectors for each major language?
Okay. You will have a switch on the back too. who else up there?
Write these down. My name is Fabian. I'm a master's student in international political economy. I had a question regarding your outsourcing theory. For this to work, communication infrastructure in sub-Saharan Africa would have to improve a lot. However, this would have to be provided probably from foreign financing because these governments do not have this money. Given that the governments in the north would realize that how this was hurt their labor force, they might be reluctant to even provide this financing, so the whole project might fail by them not wanting to provide this anymore. What would be your defense of this?
Okay, so we take those three questions. The first one, is it a zero-sum game? Or,
yeah.
And it's kind of related to the last questions. You know, would actually G7 countries try to stop it? And then the question, does language matter?
Right. Very good. So the zero, I don't view this at all as a zero-sum game. And the main reason is that knowledge is non-rival. So
explain that, because that's...
Yeah. So basic idea is that knowledge can be used in two places at the same time. And when I said the knowledge moved from the G7 to the emerging markets, I probably should have said that it spread. And although the G7 countries as a whole have been growing slowly, they've been growing. What's amazing is the fantastic growth that has been in the rest of the world economy, and this 650 million people coming out of dire poverty doesn't look like a zero-sum game to me. So I don't view there as a fixed pie, especially when knowledge is moving. Because, I mean, in the extreme, let's suppose that the movement of knowledge spread everywhere. There's no particular reason that everybody couldn't have much higher living standards if they all had better know-how. So especially the knowledge moving is not a zero-sum game. But even if it was just trade, it's not really a zero-sum game, because everybody has this buy low, sell high deal when prices are different. You do what you do best, and you import the rest. And since everybody is competitive in something, there's some sort of gain. I mean, I probably don't have to tell you, you've taken the trade class as well. But in any case, that's my... This in particular is not zero-sum, because it's knowledge.
Yeah, so there were a few other questions. So
the language. So have you seen the app iTranslate? So it's okay, but if you remember, Google Translate was like if you had multilingual friends, it was like a party game to type in the thing and see what it said. But now it's pretty good, and actually the iTranslate isn't so bad either. You talk into it. So very soon we're going to be in the Star Trek world where language is not a barrier.
Yeah.
So the maid driving the robot cleaning the room is speaking Swahili, and her supervisor is speaking Spanish, and they're all communicating through what sounds like the local language. As one of my favorite, if you want to see what the future is, watch Star Trek. You undoubtedly have watched a lot of Star Trek. Yeah. I'd just like to point out this. Star Trek is not science fiction. It's a documentary. iPhones, iPads, yeah. Well, Trello transporters could take a while, but all the rest.
You didn't really answer that question.
Which would they? So, first of all, I think there's an issue. So far, the governments don't listen to much of this. I think they will eventually figure it out, but so far, not. Whether they would stop it, I'm not really sure, because I don't think Africa is viewed as a big threat right now. But
I think there is a deeper point there. I mean, could they even stop it?
Could they stop it? Yeah. Right. So that is. I actually have another slide for that. I have an infographic for just such a question. This one I did by myself. You like that one? All right. Here we go.
You see what economists do in their spare time. You know.
The thing is, I'm powerless without PowerPoint, so here we go. So this is the trade barriers that the people would try to put up. But the knowledge goes across the borders seamlessly. It's very, very hard to stop. And in particular, you'd have to have...
I think your microphone... Oh,
yeah. You'd have to have a massively disruptive change in our society to prevent the knowledge from leaving. So just let me give you an example. Dyson moved Dyson technology from Britain to Malaysia and moved the production along with it. How would you stop that?
That's what they call Brexit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he was Brexiting. But in any case, how would you stop that? I'm not really sure you could. Now, perhaps Malaysia could, because they have a more controlled society and less developed information infrastructure. But they have no incentive to do it. So my guess is you cannot stop this stuff. But if you were going to stop it, you'd have to talk to the companies doing it,
yeah,
not look for barriers.
Or a person in rural Zimbabwe to do the job here in London,
right.
Somebody would have to provide an internet connection to rural Zimbabwe that is so strong that you can do the job. And I don't see how Zimbabwe itself could finance it. And if we become aware of that, we would also not want to finance it because we would lose our jobs.
It's a possibility. I don't see that in the development priorities of most governments. And also, there's the private sector. I mean, if there's a lot of the information technology in India isn't necessarily all paid for by the government, it's companies like Infosys, they're all on board on doing it. So it's a possibility, but I don't have anything other to say about that.
Where is your mic?
Oh, I took it over here. Yeah.
Who's next? So, to inform, are there no women who are interested in trade here? I'm disappointed. Yeah, come on.
Thanks again for the fantastic pictures.
Yeah. It's been a long time on those. Thank you very much.
My question really is, like I said, where the companies are free to move things, which is fantastic for them, and it is not a zero-sum game for them, because if you're as a company, whether it's Uber, Amazon, or whatever, it's getting more clients, getting more customers. The problem becomes in legislations. It is not moving in the same direction as everything else. Isn't it about time then that legislation and politics went global as well? And I don't mean just capitalism, but I mean laws, judicial system, and so on. What are your thoughts on this?
It doesn't seem to be on top of people's mind right now to have a global government. But let's take that. It's an important point. So who else? So one in the middle. These are the. Okay.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That was really cool. So I'm a gender studies alum, so I'm not an economist, so do bear with me. But you talked quite a little bit about teleintelligence and sort of the disruption that it could provide. But you didn't really sort of focus, perhaps because you didn't have time, on artificial intelligence and how basically the impact it could have on low-skilled jobs anywhere in the world. My question here was, in the West, now we sort of safeguard our citizens from the disruptions that globalization have so far inflicted on local economies by stuff like universal income or we haven't actually implemented that, but that's the idea, and welfare and sort of a welfare state and a move to a knowledge-based economy. So a lot of people go to universities and stuff like that. However, in the West, we've had plenty of time to actually accumulate the capital, economic culture, and so on, in order to be able to provide that for our citizens, whereas you have countries which are only now starting to industrialize, and you said people are only now coming out of poverty, and there's a developing middle class. So in a very near future, when stuff like driverless cars or factories that work without human supervision are a fact, and a fact globally, then how do you foresee this is going to be taken as a change by the increasing amount of people in countries that do not have the means to safeguard them from those changes?
Right.
Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Salim, and I'm a first-year economics student here at the LSE. So the free information of knowledge has led to a hauling out of the middle class and has led to more inequality in the United States and Europe than ever before. Do you think that this necessarily entails that governments have a burden to go towards redistributive policies, or do you think that there's some other method that governments can employ to make globalization work?
Right.
So I think we'll take those three and take another round in a moment. But it's about global government. Do we need this to make this work? And it's sort of related to your point, I think, also. And then there was the global jobs, AI, future. Of
all. Right. So on the
Star Trek.
Star Trek, yeah, again, yeah, running one more time. On the legislation thing. So I think there is already the whole mega regional TTIP, TPP was in essence a move towards that. Well, I think the correct way to think about TPP is a system of governance or rules that underpins international production. Mm. So it's a common law, common practice. It's not all the way to common politics or common economics, but the governance there's a big push to expand governance to be more international. And in fact, I would say that that's what the single market is in Europe, which started back in '86. There was no tariffs, no quotas at the time, and they were integrating the production networks in Europe, started before they called it outsourcing. And the free movement of goods
people, capital, services, that was underpinning Factory Europe. And the need or the feeling that you needed a common set of rules and therefore some common political guidance, I think was driven by this kind of factories crossing borders aspect. We've just recently had a backlash. TPP died, TTIP's going to die, lots of the other ones are going to get put on hold or die. So there's a backlash against that now. But let me just take a big swing at that for the moment. Those of you who know Polanyi, the idea of Polanyi was that the industrialization of society disrupted society. And the people who were disrupted by it reacted by embracing fascism and communism. That's what he calls the double movement. But this isn't something, it's not quite as bad, but the idea that this is incredibly disruptive and is leading the losers to push back and embrace things that potentially are bad for them as well, but they're just desperate. I think that is possibility of an issue. And this breaking up of the rules is one of the signs of that. Let's hope it doesn't go that far. But I wanted to take the excuse to talk about that, even if it was on your question. So disruption, AI, and the factoryless economy. So if you go way out, there's a great video on Google called "The Last Job in the World." So just type it in, and you'll see. And it's like
it's not yours.
It's not your video. No, it's everybody. Everything is done by robots, except there's one woman in charge of everything. And the video is her driving into the office. She opens up her computer, and her computer fires her. So, you know, in this situation, when the robots are making everybody and three people own the robots, you have to find a way of distributing the production to the consumers that is not linked to the production. Right now, we have a system which comes from ancient times where you get what you produce, more or less, and the government's, you know, stirring things around on the side. When people aren't doing things, eventually you need some way of distributing it, and that almost surely will be the minimum income. In Switzerland, we had a vote on that, and the voters said no, but they were going to impose a minimum income in Switzerland for everybody, no matter what you did. And it seems eventually that is the way it has to be. Because right now, the idea that you get paid your marginal product doesn't make much sense when you're not making anything. It's the robots making stuff. But that's, I think, a century out. So I would leave that aside.
A century?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Because this automation is, there's a lot of cheap workers in the world. Mm-hmm. So we're a long way from it. So let me talk about the automation. I have another slide you'll be happy to know. If you see a slide you really like, just like suck in the breath like that and make me feel very good. Are we on board for this? Okay. No, that's not it. That's not it. Well, that's not so good. Anyways, well, maybe this one isn't. Oh, thank you. There's a crowd that's really on my side.
Yeah, the whole sucking sound.
Right.
The
right. Yeah, that's the jobs going out. Right. Okay. So this is a set of slides I prepared last week in Washington to talk about the Trump Tariff Act of 2017. And one of the points is jobs. So right now, U.S. workers are competing with robots at home and China abroad. And in case you don't know, that struggle's not going well. But these offshore jobs that Trump wants to bring back on shore by tearing up NAFTA and putting on 35% tariffs on China, those jobs were typically low-skilled and routine and thus prone to automation. So the jobs that were offshore perhaps would have been replaced anyways by automation, and this disruption would accelerate that general trend. So the economic logic is that this sort of unbundling will lead to lots of jobs for robots and few jobs for U.S. workers. So when you were saying in the future when robots are making everything, these are two real U.S. factories right now. They're assembling cars. Now, if you look extremely closely, you will see a guy there. That's the worker.
We believe you.
And I guarantee you he is not a low-skilled worker. He's the one who's calling the engineers when something goes wrong. And there's another guy over here kneeling. It's hard to see him. Okay? So the jobs that come back may very well be mostly automated. This is a General Electric facility, which was built in a disused factory in Detroit. And again, if you look extremely closely, you see a guy with a white glove here, and he's behind here. So there is actually a worker in this factory. But what we clearly have here is that the men are helping machines make stuff, Whereas in the old days, machines were helping men make things. That's why we call it manufacturing. And this is really compufacturing. And so it's really, really in a different world. So that's what to do about it. I mean, in the end, especially if you're in rich countries, you should just disassociate industry and factories. So there are increasingly good jobs, service-related jobs, to industry that don't involve fabrication. And that's really what we have to concentrate. When we do industrial policy, we have to forget that industry isn't just meaning factories. I'll give you a small example. In Japan, there's a clothing company called Uniqlo. You ever heard of it?
Yes.
So that company is a Japanese company, a high-wage company. It's one of the largest clothing producers in Asia. But they don't make a single stitch of the clothing. What they use is the Japanese culture of excellence to design the clothes, to figure out what people want to have, and organize the things so it's delivered in a very low-cost way. So there's a lot of profits involved in making, this is low-end clothes, this is like T-shirts and stuff like that, it's not high-end clothing. There's a lot of profits in low-end clothing that are being made in a high-wage country that have nothing to do with the factories. So I think that's what you have to think about.
I mean, you kind of answered the question on inequalities. Yeah. You have inequalities within countries and inequalities across countries. And so, can you say a little bit how this will play into that?
Well, I mean, I think the...
You didn't use the elephant curve. Well, you did.
Let me see. You want
this one. You'll like this one. I mean, probably most of you have seen it, but...
The Milanovic. Yeah. Okay, I skipped over that, so... Yeah. And I want a sucking sound out of this one, okay?
This one actually is...
This was the best one, wasn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Can you explain the geese?
Here we go. The geese, yeah. So probably you've seen Milanovic elephant chart. This was the chart of the year last year. And so on this axis, we have the percent income rise in the 20 years between 1988 and 2008. So here you made 100% rise in income over that time. And this is the individual position on the 1988, the starting global distribution. So the idea here is this isn't by country, it's by people. So Milanovic took all the people of the world, surveyed, lined them up in this. This is the poorest guy in the world. This is the richest guy in the world. So this is their initial position. And what you see is that the lower half of the income distribution did reasonably well. The really poor had very, very little growth. The ones who really won is this point A, which is the middle class in China and India, which got these pipelines and they rapidly industrialized and got rapid growth, about 80% over this time. This is the middle class in the G7, and they saw no growth during this time in their incomes, stagnation. And the idea is that the knowledge that these guys used to have a monopoly on then went to these guys, and that explains that. Whereas this is the G7 rich class, and those are the knowledge owners who now could leverage their knowledge better. That's the basic idea. But to get to the bigger idea of what to do about this thing, this is where do we go here? Okay, what's the way forward? So I'm like a politician. I'm not answering the questions they're asking. I'm just answering the questions that I want to answer. That's okay.
You're doing fine.
Yeah, thanks. So what's the way forward? First, you have to accept 21st century reality. The new globalization isn't something foreigners are doing to us. It's something that G7, this part of it, is something that G7 firms are doing. U.S. competitiveness depends upon factory North America, since the new globalization has denationalized comparative advantage. So the response is going to be very different. And in particular, you can't vote against globalization by voting against the agreements that control and shape it. The old globalization tools control trade flows, but they don't work on new globalization knowledge flows. So the solutions that people like Brexit are going to think are going to fix anything, or Trump is going to fix anything, it's like the patient has a broken leg and they're applying antibiotics to fix it. You know, still good medicine, it's just the wrong diagnosis. And in particular, if you think about that infographic where you're making it expensive to move imported intermediates into the country, but the knowledge keeps going, you could have very unintended effects of trying to use 20th century tools to fix a 21st century problem. So one more analogy would be, let's suppose you had a great big factory and you wanted more factory jobs at the beginning of the assembly line. And you tried to do that by building a big wall in the middle of the factory. So there actually might be some jobs that would come before, but the primary effect would be to ruin the competitiveness of the factory. And that's what, you know, disrupting NAFTA would do to U.S. industry, would just make it less competitive. So the other reality is manufacturing jobs for low-skilled G7 workers are not coming back. There may be some jobs for robots, but the jobs are not coming back. So the logic that people have been using, globalization is driven forward by falling trade costs, more trade in goods, leads to the natural but completely wrong solution that we have to put the barriers back up. But once you realize what's really changed in the last 20 years is knowledge crossing borders, the proposition that putting the barriers back up is going to help things is a much trickier thing. So that's the reality. The second is, and this comes to your what to do about it, rebuilding the team. We have to restore social cohesion with policies that protect individual workers, not individual jobs, such as retraining, education, mobility support, income support, maybe even sort of active clusters policy or industrial policy to help out the people who are left behind, because it's very regional as well. So that's the key thing. We have to ensure, if we want to keep a consensus and avoid the kind of double movement that happened in the 30s, ensure that everybody feels that they're going to share in the gains and the pains of globalization in advance. So I think a lot of it has to do with packaging it politically. So what we need to be talking about is trade policy in the service of society, not just trade policy. This is from a paper that Tony Venables and Paul Collier and I are going to publish very soon. So when proposing more open trade and international production sharing policies, we should also propose policies that help the economically disenfranchised and package them together so that people sort of think this is all going together. So I really do think we need more of a kind of Danish welfare system so that everybody is taken care of. And it's kind of important that we don't call it trade-related or globalization-related, because it's actually impossible to decide why somebody's lost their job. Is it automation? Is it aging? Is it globalization? So you shouldn't have to be able to identify that it was this. If anybody loses their job, you should help them. And that's part of the deal. So I do think strengthening the social welfare system is important. And so that's my guess is how to fix it.
Okay.
I don't know if that answered the question, but I talked for a little while.
Yeah, you did. So question here in the middle. I won't take more men asking questions.
Thank you. So you talked about denationalizing comparative advantage and it being moved into the power of corporations. And you also talked about just then protecting the people at the bottom of society at a time when most neoliberal economies, if anything, during their financial struggles are moving away from that. A corporation tax at a higher level would seem logical in that kind of scenario, but doesn't seem very viable with lots of countries racing to try and get corporate investment. So how do you, just to sort of get you to expand more on packaging it politically, how do you actually make this something that is not only viable but also could have a positive effect on society?
Right. That's a tough one.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you very much. Is it the case that this is suitable for all industries? Or are there some industries it wouldn't be suitable for to pass around the world? I mean, the know-how is perhaps not a relevant issue in that.
Yeah. So it's a differential impact across industries.
And secondly, have there been corporations or industries that came back from China and restarted in the United States?
So reshoring, how important is that? Anyone else?
There's no answer.
Oh. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm a master's student in development management in LSE. So my question will be, so as you can see, now if there is some business succeed in one part of the world, and you see the similar type of business emerging in other parts of the world. So for example, before Airbnb entered China, there were a bunch of entrepreneurs there already doing a very similar type of business after they knew this type of business existing in the USA. So my question would be, so how do you see this phenomenon? Will you see less impact the globalization brought on entrepreneurship? And will you see less any need to regulate it? Because in this way, the profit doesn't go to the original company, which start with the idea. Or you think that's a very good way to just make the whole world better? Thank you.
Okay, so again, three questions. One on, you know, how do you package this politically? I mean, you have it, you know, some one suggestion. I guess, you know, what you're proposing is not so different from what we are sort of arguing today. So how it's really different. And then, of course, the differential impact across industries and,
Globalization, yeah, entrepreneurship.
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So the political thing, that's I'm an optimist. I think they're going to work it out. I think, especially in the United States, the people who voted Trump in are going to be really angry in another couple years, and it's possible that a populist left would get would be elected rather than a populist right, and they know how to tax and spend, and that's so that it's possible that it would move that way. The other is, if you look at countries like Japan and many, not all the Europeans, but to a certain extent, who have the massive welfare systems on high tax base, they're doing better. So clearly it's possible to do it. I think Japan is a pretty good example where, it's caused a lot of problems in Japan. They call it the hollowing out of the economy, they call it. It's caused a lot of problems. But you don't see movements to the far left or far right, or at least increasing movements. So I think it's possible. It's really, you just have to tax things that don't move around too much, and then make it a compact. So that's. But if I really, I don't have the studied political answer. I would just look around the world and try and collect best practices to countries that have helped the economically disenfranchised, and then try and study that. All the industries? No, actually not. In one of the versions of this talks, when I use much more regressions and charts and things like that, you can see this whole outsourcing thing is concentrated in a few industries. It's in machinery, chemicals, apparel, and electronics. Those are the big industries. But there are lots of other industries in which you do not see the unbundling. We have a very good data set called the trade and value-added data set, where you can actually trace this stuff down and see which sectors it works. So it hasn't happened much in services, and it's only really happened in a few of the classic manufacturing sectors. And I think it's basically because they're not modular. It's difficult to break it up. Either there's lots of face-to-face needed, or it's just you can't make a bit of it here and then move it over there just because you can't separate it. So that's I think, true. There has been reshoring, but a lot of times it's this automated reshoring. So the value-added comes back, but the jobs don't. So a point that I make in the book, which I didn't have time to talk about, is that there's, in some sense, information technology, which allows automation, is leading to a rebundling of the factories, because one worker can do all the tasks, and there's no gain to breaking it up, whereas communication technology makes it easier to break it up and move it off. So as ICT advances, you get tendencies to reshore and tendencies to offshore, and you don't know which way they go. But the interesting thing is that IT information technology is systematically more knowledge intensive, more skill intensive, and more capital intensive. So as we adopt more IT intensive manufacturing processes, they more naturally belong in the G7. So I think there will be a lot of reshoring, but of robot jobs, not real jobs. So then the last one is the IP leakage and entrepreneurship and stuff like that. So IP protection is a government-granted monopoly, which is a distortion, designed to correct another distortion, which is the spillovers of knowledge creation. So you create knowledge, and in principle, everybody can take it. And if everybody did take it, then you wouldn't have invented it because it cost you something. So the government grants a temporary distortion monopoly, a patent, to counter the other distortion, and it's definitely in a second best world. Now, when you move that abroad and people start absorbing the knowledge without paying for the patent or getting the patent, that's part of the story of the 600 million coming out of poverty. There was this IP leakage, and as a global citizen, you have to say, well, that's pretty good. But you also have to at the same time understand that it's been extremely disruptive to communities in G7 countries. And in particular, IP theft is an issue that gets people very excited. So I don't know exactly where to go with it, but I don't think they can stop it. I don't think we can have any wonderful reforms. But that's what a lot of these trade agreements are about, is protecting the intellectual property rights. That almost all the new trade agreements have that sort of stuff. So it's a government reaction. But I'll just leave it as an issue.
Okay, let's take one last round of questions. So an operator here, one there, and one.
I'm Pierre-Marie de Lenner. I'm an industrialist. Question about industrial policy. That's a word from the past, I guess. But do you see a possibility or resurgence of, nation politicians trying to influence or promote national champions, trying to influence their policies in order to essentially pleasure the electorate?
So the resurgence of industrial policy. I'll take you also later, but one there and then one in the middle.
I just wondered what you think the effects might be on the financial services sector, if indeed any at all, because in theory this can be done anywhere at all in the world, if the skill base is there.
Thanks. Forgetting the sort of inevitability of it, do you think that the increased use of robots will have a positive impact on the global wealth or a negative one?
Mm. Okay, and last question here.
Thank you. I'm a PhD from here in international relations since 1975, and I've worked for the many manufacturing organizations and the U.S. Congress in the U.S. And I've looked at these issues quite a bit, and that's an excellent presentation. The question I have is kind of complicated and gets into economics a little bit. We've looked at the issue of declining share of manufacturing, but that's based on but we know that the cost of manufactured goods has fallen faster than services. So in reality, that's a reflection on the improvement in manufacturing efficiency due to all these causes you've been talking about, including offshoring and imported inputs. And the last point is that an OECD estimate says maybe half of all services are directly related to manufacturing, right, subcontracting. So it seems to me that your story is a little too cheerful, as it were, in the sense that you can't sustain the services jobs if you have a declining manufacturing, you have a high manufacturing output, but a declining share of services being provided for that output, if you follow the logic there. Sorry, I've tried to shorten it.
Sure.
But that's the best I can do.
Yeah. Okay, so I think you have
a few minutes. Four questions. Okay. Yeah. So industrial policy, is that the first one, right? Industrial policy. There is a whole chapter in the book on how developed countries should react to this, and there's a segment in there on industrial policy. And a number of the points I make is that, first of all, we should separate industrial policy from factories. And there is, as it came for the second question, there's a very important servicification of manufacturing. And as a kind of global trend is that fabrication is going to factories in poor countries, but the associated services are going to cities in rich countries. And I think that's the way we should start to think about industrial policy. And in particular, as I argue in the book, governments should think about cities as 21st century factories in the G7 countries and worry about that. And just realize you're not going to get the factory jobs back. They've been essentially commoditized. Also, I don't think we have industrial policy anymore because we don't have sectors anymore. Well, for instance, if they close the borders, Britain couldn't make almost anything. because they're putting together the, and not just Britain. I mean, Germany couldn't make cars. The U.S. couldn't make aircraft. It's the whole thing is this globalized, not globalized factory, but regional factories of parts and components. So we're not really trying to choose, should it be the steel sector or it's clusters. And cluster policy instead of industrial policy, I think, is here. It's much less dangerous in the sense that you're not making an enormous bet on the, you know, electric car industry, or so you're just doing one factory or one stage at a time. And I think governments are involved in that, should be involved in that, and it's not the old industrial policy.
Can I just challenge, yeah, because I think industrial policy has come back with a vengeance in the global, since the global financial crisis. So, and it's indeed, it's a different type of industrial policy. But so in this country now, even the new government has the industrial strategy in its, in the name of the ministry that the BIS. So it's now stands for industrial strategy. So it's, you know, clearly there's a role for the government and in your world Here you have this, for example, in the aerospace industry, we have the Aerospace Technology Institute, or whatever it's called, you know, which is a kind of it's organized around the technology. It's maybe not a sector as such, as you say. You know, how should we think of what is it that the government does in industrial policy?
Right. Well, so what I don't have all the answers to that, but I have a way of perhaps thinking about it. It's differently, and it's in the book. So I think industrial policy deep down is trying to booster the source of comparative advantage inside a nation, whether it's raising the skills, increasing technology, increasing social capital, whatever it is. You're trying to boost the comparative advantage inside a country. But in this world where more stuff is mobile, in particular knowledge, you have to worry about the stickiness of the stuff you're doing. So when you do an industrial policy, it's no use, for example, using taxpayers' money to develop new products which next year will be produced somewhere abroad. That's that knowledge, know-how is much less sticky. So, for example, the old nostrum that we should subsidize R&D, no matter what it is probably less true than it was before. Whereas looking for things like human capital, especially in industries where you have networks of humans working together, and that's the financial service sector, to come to that, is one of the sectors which is very hard to disrupt and offshore, because you require networks of people with talents interacting with each other on a daily basis, because the stuff they're doing every day is different. It's not so routine. So I think when you design your industrial policy, you have to realize I'm promoting some product, whatever it is, and you want to promote products that will stay inside your country. If your taxpayers are paying for it, it should stay inside the country. So that's one way of sort of evaluating that. It's in the book. The financial sector, as I said, you know, we're still in a world where expensive people sit in expensive buildings in expensive cities, and doesn't seem to be subject to kind of offshoring. And well, first of all, wait till telepresence gets going. We'll see what happens. I think at least a large part of what they're doing in those expensive buildings could be potentially offshored. But a lot of financial services are so non-routine, are so customized and changing so fast with such deadlines that to save on the face-to-face cost, people have to be together. So there's a strong agglomeration in the financial service sector, which I think is somewhat immune to this sort of stuff. On the robots, plus or minus, I mean, I think there. When you think about robots, it's essentially automation, and it's the same question of when cars replaced all the horse-driven carts. You know, there was many fewer drivers because a truck could bring four cart loads, replaced a lot of jobs. It's essentially automation, and that replacement will be disruptive. It's probably ultimately good for society, and if it actually works, then the machines will do all the work, and you know we'll give each other haiku lessons and yoga lessons, and you'll be divorced lawyer and you know dog trainer, stuff like that. You know, we'll, just like in Star Trek, to come back to the documentary, they work for personal prestige because the robots make everything, and so people are motivated by what gets the prestige, what gets the essential appreciation of their peer group rather than actually working for money. So if it goes that far, I think it could actually be a good thing. In the meantime, we have to avoid another Polanyi double reaction that people get so upset and so disruptive society that they embrace some choices that are bad, that are quite bad. But ultimately, I just think it's, you know, automation.
Okay, I think we... Yes,
sure. You did say that you might come back to the movement of people.
Right.
The third.
Okay. Well, okay. So that was the virtual presence. See, it's the movement of services, labor services, without the movement of people. Hmm. Well, to actually remove the cost of moving people will take a technology that I don't think we have. Because even if you go to supersonic jets, it's really hard to go to Australia or Japan from here. You lose a lot of days, and so it's just not worthwhile doing. So that I don't change, but I could be giving, for example, lectures tomorrow in Japan if the telecommunications work well enough, and that's a substitute for being there. So what I view is close substitutes to the face-to-face constraint, relaxing some elements of it.
So next time you come, he will come as a hologram. So.
I'm starting to do that, actually. That would be me up there talking.
I remember
in
the early days of holograms, I went to listen to a lecture by Alan Greenspan, I thought. But he was there as a hologram, and he was standing at the very back of the stage, you know, whatever you call it, sent in from New York. The problem was that the technology was such that you could only see, only half of the room could see him. The rest was just, but I think the technology has improved.
So even
this may be your future career as a hologram.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I think we have really got a lot of things to think about in terms of, you know, what is globalization and what drives globalization. What is the impact? And we have a lot of very serious consequences of this process. And then you have tried to say what could we do about it. And I think the answers are difficult, and they need to be. There are a lot of details that have to get right for this to really work smoothly, and I don't think the ride is, unfortunately, probably not going to be as smooth as we would like. But thank you so much for coming and sharing with us. Big applause.
Great.
That was very good.